This is Thinking About OBGYN with your hosts, Antonia Roberts and Howard Harrell.
Antonia.
Howard.
What are we thinking about on today's episode?
Well, we're going to talk about the ARRIVE trial finally. It's a very long overdue topic for us. And there's also some recent really good articles from AJOG, the Gray Journal. But first, what's the thing we do for no reason?
All right. Well, how about telling women who have preterm contractions or threatened preterm labor that they're dehydrated or giving them IV fluids as a treatment when they come to labor and delivery to be evaluated?
Okay. Yeah. So women will often come in to triage with preterm contractions, which usually is not preterm labor, but sometimes it does turn out to be that. So some facilities will routinely get a urinalysis to look for dehydration or a UTI. And if their urine does indicate either of those things, then usually that will be deemed to be the cause of their contractions, or at least a contributor. And a lot of triage nurses, I think, will specifically ask patients who are showing up with contractions, how much have they been hydrating? And in almost all cases, no matter what the answer is, they'll determine, oh, well, that's not enough. That's you're contracting because you just didn't drink enough. And then they'll give them like a jug of ice water or something or some juice. And maybe in some more extreme cases, they'll go ahead and start an IV and give them a fluid bolus.
Yeah, and they really pathologize sort of Braxton Hicks contractions that are normal physiologic things and make there have to be a reason for them. But what really happens during that 2 or 3 hours is maybe their contractions quiet down and they're waiting there, drinking fluids, getting IV fluids, getting their cervix rechecked, and they likely will have fewer contractions at the end of it if they've been having Braxton Hicks contractions. So the question is, dehydration really the reason why those contractions were occurring? And even if that's the case, does telling a patient to hydrate or giving them IV fluids make some measurable difference in their outcomes? Like, are they less likely to have preterm birth?
Well, I think there's a couple explanations for this. So firstly, there's a very nifty little physiologic mechanism, or at least a theory, which is that oxytocin and vasopressin are both neuropeptides that are both synthesized in the hypothalamus and secreted from the posterior pituitary. And vasopressin, which is antidiuretic hormone, is released when essentially when people are thirsty. It regulates the tonicity of body fluids. So if the body fluids are hypertonic because the patient is dehydrated, then it'll cause the kidneys to absorb more free water and return it to the circulation. So if you're dehydrated, your body will be stimulated to release more vasopressin. And if you're pregnant, there is some cross-stimulation with the oxytocin receptors because the vasopressin and oxytocin are similar. And so it's thought that the vasopressin will basically stimulate contractions just like oxytocin does.
Yeah, so that's the basic science explanation of it. And I think every med student has learned that physiology, and we like to think through this and create an understanding of how this might work. And we understand the mechanism and believe in it with some high degree of scientific certainty. But I do think that this is a great example, and there's tons of them, but this is a great example of the difference between a skeptical empiricist and a theorist. So for the theorist, it's very easy to take all that basic science knowledge and then translate it into clinical practice by having an intervention, like, say, IV fluids. But the skeptical empiricist would look for data, usually from a randomized controlled trial or experiment, that shows that there's actually a important and measurable clinical effect from that theoretic mechanism. So we have to test the hypothesis. And in this case, there just isn't. So two questions, I guess. The first one is, are women who come in with preterm contractions, are they typically dehydrated? Is that why they came in? And the answer is no. And this is something you should be able to get from clinical history, but there are studies that have looked at this. I mean to say that the woman's drinking fluid, she didn't just run a marathon or set out the NASCAR race for 4 hours in the sun. Why are we just assuming that they're dehydrated? But I'll put a link to a study that looked at 840 women, and they found a matching cohort of women with preterm contractions, and they compared those to a cohort without. And between the two groups of women, they found no differences in the specific gravity of the women who complained of contractions in the group of women who didn't complain of contractions.
Yeah, it's not like the typical woman coming to triage has been stranded on a desert for 3 days or something like that. Having a little bit of emesis or having a long day running errands and forgetting to fill your water bottle is going to make you feel like crap for sure, but it's not enough to actually cause clinical dehydration in someone who's otherwise healthy and otherwise has a normal water intake and normal kidney function. And in fact, most pregnant women are probably more hydrated than their non-pregnant counterparts because they've been told their whole pregnancies, you got to push fluids all the time as much as possible.
Yeah, we should talk about how much water pregnant women actually need sometime. But okay, well, then the next question is, does giving IV hydration or oral hydration, I suppose, does it make a difference in their clinical course? Does it lessen their symptoms of false labor contractions, or does it delay or alter the onset of true premature labor? This hasn't been a really serious question in obstetrics, though, since the 1990s, when multiple studies failed to reveal any prolongation of labor or any change in those outcomes at all with IV hydration. And in fact, a concern actually came up back in those days about hydrating women with IV fluids who subsequently would receive tocolytics, particularly magnesium sulfate, but other tocolytics as well, due to something called tocolytic-induced ARDS, which happened almost exclusively after women had received usually a 1 liter fluid bolus before receiving a tocolytic. So she would come in, she would have Braxton Hicks contractions. Standard treatment might be to give a liter of fluids. You recheck in a couple of hours. Now she's actually changing. So now the doctor orders a tocolytic. And those women who had received prehydration with a liter of fluids were way more likely to go into this ARDS syndrome. And that often led to ICU stays and even death, rarely.
Well, there's certainly no guideline that says we need to use IV fluids as a management for preterm labor or threatened preterm labor. We also still hear about some hospitals that routinely will give a shot of terbutaline or something like that to women in triage and then send them home. And that's most definitely not recommended. And the FDA actually cautions us against using it for that purpose. So it shouldn't be happening anymore. But
well, we know it does.
Yeah.
And there's two issues there. One, it just, again, doesn't do anything. But for the rare woman, and yes, they may need to have some pre-existing cardiac problems or something like that, but that's actually been fatal for some women. Like, that is no benefit and even rarer serious risks, then we should avoid it. So I think another important part of this is that nurses and doctors really shouldn't be telling women that they're having the contractions they're having because they're dehydrated. First of all, it's not true, but a lot of women are already, they're, as you said, they're forcing fluids. They've got their big water jug they're carrying around all the time. $60. What's the new popular one? Stanley? $60 water jugs. Yeah, they're super expensive. I think I bought you one. Do you force your water? And they're already forcing all these fluids while they're pregnant because they believe that it's important to stay hydrated, as you said. And they're told to make sure their urine is clear or that they're peeing every hour and all these things. And then they go to the hospital and then with contractions that they're concerned about. And they're told that this is happening because they're not drinking enough water. So it's really a honestly shameless move that has the effect of blaming the patient. But as I said earlier, it also creates the idea that Braxton Hicks contractions are not just a normal physiologic thing that happens during pregnancy, that perhaps even serves a function of strengthening the uterine muscle and coordinating the gap junctions between stretching myocytes and things like that. Like, these are normal things that should happen. So, but it's a form of guilt sanctioning when we blame the patient for her problem and then in turn give her an illusion of control. She doesn't really have control over it, but we make her think she does. So the problem with that is that if she really does go into preterm labor that day or afterwards, then she may blame herself because she'll look back and say, I didn't drink enough water. I did too much activity or whatever it is. I wasn't a good mother and now my baby's in the NICU because I'm a bad parent. So that's what guilt sanctioning is, and it should just never, ever happen.
I will say that when I was pregnant, I was very bad at hydrating because I was nauseous all the time. And I even just to take a sip, I had to like forcefully do it. But I never got preterm contractions. I only would sometimes have fainting episodes when I was trying to do a C-section because it gets really hot. So that's when I would really force myself to drink a little bit more water just so I wouldn't faint. But
and yeah. Your blood pressure is probably 90 over 50.
Yeah.
At rest. For the audience who can't see her, she's tiny. She's rolling her eyes.
Okay. Yeah, let's move on. So the ARRIVE trial, we have mentioned it before in prior episodes, and I'm sure most listeners have at least a general idea of what this trial was about. And a lot of doctors in the U.S. at least are using it as a carte blanche to induce every pregnancy at 39 weeks. But I know many others, and you included at least, disagree with that conclusion and with just the whole principle of it.
Yeah, well, and I'll put a link to something I wrote a few years ago. It's actually a three-part series of articles that kind of goes through some of the background, the data, and things like that about this idea. And 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, this was something that you would see debates on nationally after at ACOG meetings, things like that, after it came out, pros and cons. So those articles go into some of that. But the theory of the trial was that if you induce women at 39 weeks, you could prevent any full-term fetal demises that would occur in the low-risk patients that were included in the study, who otherwise might wait potentially up until 41 weeks for induction. And along those same lines, you could also prevent any increased fetal distress that might be associated at full-term that might have led to things like increased C-sections in patients who waited past 39 weeks, if they had some placental senescence and meconium-stained fluid or things like that by prolonging these periods. So you could reduce the rates of those things as well. And technically, they potentially could have had people in the comparator group who went to 42 weeks, because the view of the standard of care is for low-risk women is that you'd like to go to 41. For women with unfavorable cervixes, they might go to 42 with reassuring antenatal testing. So their only protocol in the study was that you had to be delivered by 42. And so there is some increasing rate of intrauterine fetal demise, even among the lowest risk patients, from 39 to 40, from 40 to 41, and certainly from 41 to 42. So let's prevent all that by inducing these women at 39 weeks. That was the idea.
Yes, that definitely seems to have been the premise. And they had an expected rate of their primary perinatal outcome, which was a composite of death and several different severe morbidities. And so based on that expected rate, they made a power analysis and decided how many people they would need to reasonably show a certain difference. They ended up slightly exceeding that target enrollment, and then actually seeing that their primary outcome was more frequent than what they had estimated. So they definitely had enough patients and enough information to answer their question of whether this benefits babies. And what they ended up seeing was that the composite outcome was not different. And among each of the individual components of that composite outcome, which individually did not have their own power analyses done, the most significant finding was that there was a slightly higher rate in the control group babies of needing respiratory support. And so that was 4.2% in the expectant management compared to 3% in the 39-week induction group. But even that outcome had a confidence interval that approached one. It almost got to one, but it didn't. So that was the only one that actually was, you could say, significant, although it didn't, again, it didn't have its own power analysis. Notably, the rates of perinatal death were the exact same between the two groups. And it actually appeared that seizures were higher, 4 times higher in the induction group at 39 weeks, but that was a very rare outcome. It was 0.4% in the induction group compared to 0.1% in the expected management group. So definitely underpowered to conclude anything from that.
And I'll interrupt you just briefly that obviously if they had, you could look back and say, if they had a bigger study, then maybe that composite income outcomes would become statistically significant, or clearly so, if they had more numbers and that trend continued. Now, that's an assumption. But in the same way, you could say that if they had more numbers, that rate of seizures would have become statistically significant if that trend continued.
Yeah.
But I will say, while people think that way, that when they see a trend, if we just made a larger study, then you know it would become true, it's actually quite common that as studies expand, what looks like a trend goes back to zero or goes the other way, because it's really a sampling problem. So the power analysis is very important. And as you pointed out, they exceeded the expectations of their power analysis. So if they're going to find something, they should have found it.
Yeah. And so they had set out with an estimated composite perinatal outcome, morbidity and mortality, of 3.5%. So if they were only looking at C-section rate, they could have had a much lower enrollment because C-sections are much more common than 3.5%. So to have any commentary on C-section rate from this study, one could say that they were over-enrolled for that. But they did find almost a 4% difference in the C-section rate that favored the 39-week induction group. So that was just over, it was like 18.6% in the 39-week induction group and 22% in the expectant management group. And this finding definitely went against our knowledge at the time that inducing unfavorable primiparous patients would increase the C-section rate rather than decrease it.
And remember, novel findings that contradict the rest of the known scientific literature at the time require validation and replication. They're novel for a reason, and we should have a natural distrust of them and not automatically assume that every other study was wrong up until that point. So this was, as you said, a novel finding. Well, and also I think it's important to remember here that they didn't achieve what the point of the study was, which was to have a reduction in the composite adverse perinatal outcome metric that was severe morbidity or death. So this was a negative trial. But like so many times when a negative trial is published, especially a big, important multicenter trial NIH funded, the authors try to gild the lily and find some positive benefit, perhaps from a subset analysis or some angle to show that their intervention has some merit. And in this case, it was this purported reduction in the rate of cesarean delivery that you talked about.
Well, that primary cesarean delivery rate from this study that they're discussing is not equal to the true primary cesarean delivery rate, nor is it even equal to the NTSV rate, which stands for nulliparous term singleton vertex. Because even though everyone in the study was NTSV, they excluded anyone that had any kind of risk factor, which a regular NTSV rate doesn't exclude. So, for example, they excluded people who had vaginal bleeding or premature rupture of membranes at the time of induction. They excluded everyone who had any kind of indication for delivery before 40 weeks, or actually 40 and 5, including hypertensive disorders, growth restriction, or any other maternal or fetal condition that would normally be considered a reason for earlier delivery. So this really, in the ARRIVE trial, was the lowest of the lowest risk population.
Yeah, these are practically patients who meet all the home birth guideline criteria. You're not going to find a healthier, lower risk patient population in any hospital. And it's certainly not reflective of any normal hospital's patient population that I'm aware of. And that's my primary criticism of their finding. So the primary cesarean rate in the United States when this study was published was around 21.6%. And the NTSV rate that you mentioned, it actually runs higher than the primary section rate because the denominator is different. The primary section rate is calculated as a rate per 100 live births. So when we say the primary section rate is 21.6%, and since that includes primiparous patients and multiparous patients and other folks that have twins, for example, things like that, the NTSV doesn't include, then it's literally 21.6 women out of 100 had a primary C-section. But the NTSV rate only includes first-time moms in that category. So since women who have a vaginal delivery the first time are very likely to have one the next time, and the primary section rate is calculated per 100 live births, which includes women with five prior vaginal deliveries, they get in the denominator, then the NTSV rate actually ends up being higher than the primary section rate. So at the time of this study, the NTSV rate in the United States was around 25%, a little bit higher than the primary rate of 21.6. But as you said, that would include women with hypertension or pre-labor rupture of membranes that they excluded, or women with gestational diabetes, or women with growth restriction or macrosomia, or all these other women that they risked out of the study. They were excluded, but this is a population of women who typically have a higher primary cesarean rate. They contribute a disproportionate amount to the NTSV section rate, and they were excluded from the study. So my point of that is, it's a very fair criticism to say that the 22.2% rate that they had in their control group was way higher than it should have been. And frankly, even an 18.6% rate, which is where they ended up in that population, is really not much to brag about. And this is lost on people who don't understand the difference between primary and NTSV and are thinking about what the rate should be in this population. You can't compare these numbers one to another and assume that their 22.2% rate was a good rate in some manner. So I actually talked to one of the authors of the study who was presenting about their data at a national meeting, and he agreed. He said, if you have an NTSV rate that's already south of the 18 or so percent that we ended up with, then you're likely harming your patients by inducing them at 39 weeks, particularly in the setting that they found no perinatal benefit. It didn't benefit the babies.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, some have defended this by responding to that criticism that although they were powered for the composite outcome, which showed no difference, they were not powered for the most important perinatal outcome, which was mortality, because that happened in 0.1% of both groups.
Right. So what we imagine what would have happened with a larger study. And again, we don't know. I will say in this study that they did something that I like, and you mentioned that they over-enrolled. And so when you over-enroll, your power analysis is affected by that. And so you have to go back and determine a new threshold for statistical significance, because one way that you can lower a p-value is by increasing enrollment or the n number of subjects in your study. So they did that, and they determined that a statistically significant p-value would be less than 0.046 instead of the normal 0.05 that studies often use. And the p-value they found for their primary outcome was 0.049. So much respect to that, because you might see a slide where the p-value is 0.049 and somebody says, ah, that's statistically significant, but actually it wasn't. And they had to do that posteriori power analysis to determine that, and they did. But I also would like to point out that in this same journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, with some of the exact same authors on the byline from the same network of studies who published this paper, they did not do this in the BEAM trial. So in the BEAM trial, they calculated the posteriori power analysis, and they said they chose not to use it. Now, the BEAM study is the reason that we're still using magnesium sulfate today to prevent cerebral palsy, and the p-value in that study was above the corrected threshold, but they chose not to correct it. So I've criticized that study widely in the past. And in this publication, which is about 10 years later with different editors of the journal and things like that, they made the corrections and the adjustments that the BEAM trial chose not to make. And my point of that is only that had the same statistical rigor been used in the BEAM trial, we would not be using magnesium right now to prevent cerebral palsy. So the statistics are important, and we have to pay attention to these things. But they did have, in this study, they did have 3 perinatal deaths in the expectant management group and 2 in the induction group. And so, yeah, it's possible that a larger trial would show a mortality benefit. And that, again, that's one of the defenses of the study is we know these fetal demises occur. We know the rates of them. If we could have more patients, we would see that. But I think we have to, again, be careful speculating about what a larger trial might show, because a different trial might also show a higher cesarean rate and maternal morbidity related to that. A larger trial might show a higher neonatal mortality rate that counteracts the gains made in a fetal demise rate. So it's up to the authors to prove the point. If you believe that a larger trial would show that, then do the study, collect the data, and we just can't give you a pass when you did the study, you designed it the way you wanted, you had it powered, and you didn't find an outcome that you wanted to find. You don't just get a pass and an assumption. If we were going to do that, then we shouldn't have done the study to begin with, right? Let's just assume that this works.
Yeah, and it's also possible that at least some of the fetuses who would have died in utero, between 39 and 41 weeks, but then were saved from stillbirth by an earlier delivery, might still have an increased risk of neonatal death. You, of course, eliminate some dangers with delivery, like the possibility of a cord or a placental accident, or maybe post-maturity type syndromes. But definitely some intrauterine fetal demises are unexplained. There's no signs that anything was wrong, but it still happened. Just like SIDS is unexplained, like when they're anytime up to 6 months old and they're totally healthy, but they still pass away. So for all we know about these somewhat mysterious processes, there could be some overlap that simply doesn't resolve with delivery at 39 weeks. But I think they accounted for that in this study. They looked at mortality before, during, and after delivery and still found no difference in the outcomes.
No, they did. And what you just described is something that we've talked a lot about, how we imposed the 39-week rule about 15 years ago because people were saying that we were going to have more fetal demises from not allowing doctors to induce women at 37 or 38 weeks and pushing it to 39. But the data shows that total perinatal mortality has gone down. And so that is a viable thing that we try to understand from this epidemiology. And I think that might be actually why the results of this study were surprising to the authors in terms of the numbers they needed to enroll to find what they wanted. They did count perinatal deaths, not just fetal deaths. So perinatal deaths would get the intrauterine fetal demises in the last few weeks of pregnancy, plus those immediate 28-day neonatal deaths. And that gives us, there's 2 perinatal metrics, perinatal 1 and 2, but they're not just assuming that just because the baby didn't die in utero, it might not die as a newborn. So perinatal deaths, I think, is the right metric to use, not neonatal deaths, not fetal deaths. Now, the other thing is, a lot of institutions have tried to implement the ARRIVE trial in the last few years, and most who've done so for those women who want it after counseling, and that's a real thing. A lot of women don't want it. But most of the people who are doing it they're not seeing lower C-section rate, but their patients on average end up being admitted for longer. And if anything, they're seeing higher cesarean rates. And that's the point, I think, about the 22% number being too high for this patient population. It's an outlier. It's not likely that this study would stand up to replication. You would repeat the study and the control group's C-section rate would be 17 or 18%, might even be 16%, and you see that it goes up with induction. So this is an outlier. And this happens in studies. That's why we have replication. This was the same problem with the original trial that in the early 2000s that concluded that 17-hydroxyprogesterone cap rate was beneficial. We know that the recurrent preterm delivery rate in the control arm of that study was much, much higher than we see basically in any other trial for the population that was studied. And so the same wisdom needs to be viewed here. They just had an outlying control arm with a high C-section rate for whatever reason. Plus, this trial, as you said, disagreed with basically every other published literature over the subject of whether or not inducing nulliparous patients at 39 weeks affected the C-section rate. For the most part, the literature says that induction of 39-week nulliparous patients with an unfavorable cervix raises the risk of cesarean for her by 50%, some studies higher, even closer to 100%, but at least a 50% increase.
Yeah, so our instinct should be that when we see a novel finding that contradicts prior literature, then we have to consider that this could be a mistake until subsequent literature either proves it to be true or the opposite. Of course, you have to compare the quality of the new data compared to the old data, but it seems like that skepticism hasn't really happened with the ARRIVE trial.
Well, I'll say that I think most physicians, it was handled with pros and cons and debates. I would say that most OBGYNs have not adopted the ARRIVE trial. But quite a few have, as you said. Now, I'll put a link to a study from the University of Wisconsin where they implemented the ARRIVE trial counseling into their practice in an attempt to induce women at 39 weeks. But of course, many of the women will refuse this. They're just counseling them that it may reduce their risk of C-section, essentially. Now, sometimes the people who implemented also say it may prevent fetal demises. And I would caution you, if you're telling patients that inducing at 39 weeks will improve neonatal outcomes, you're doing that without any scientific basis. And if you're cautioning them that it will lower C-section rate, that should probably be in the context of where you have a very high NTSV rate at your institution. If you have a lower one, you're also misleading them. But the University of Wisconsin published their data pre and post COVID. And what they, because this COVID kind of came right after a lot of people started doing this. So it's interesting. And what they found was that during COVID in particular, women were much more frequently refusing the inductions. They were scared to come to the hospital or whatever. And so they were more likely to come into the hospital when they were in active labor. So even though they were doing the counseling, their induction rates went down during the pandemic. And the result was an increase in women going all the way to 41 weeks or even slightly beyond. But at the same time, in that time period, guess what? Their cesarean rate went from 20.2% to 17.9%. And remember, this was women at all risk levels, not just the ones meeting the very low-risk ARRIVE trial criteria. And to top it off, they actually had fewer fetal deaths and infant deaths, even though they had more meconium-stained amniotic fluid. So these sorts of real-world experiences that we're seeing published now after implementation of ARRIVE data or counseling based on the ARRIVE trial to patients are showing opposite effects and higher section rates when inductions go up and lower section rates when inductions go down, as COVID caused to happen at the University of Wisconsin. So the paper's interesting simply because it also shows that plenty of women don't want to be unnecessarily induced, particularly during the pandemic they didn't.
I think there are certain people that would still like the option of an earlier delivery if it was offered. I have patients that end up being very uncomfortable by the time they're like 36 weeks and they want their babies out as soon as humanly possible and gladly take that 39-week induction. And then there's especially the families where their relatives are coming in from out of town to help and they only have limited time off from work, or they have to make childcare arrangements. For some of them, it's nice to be able to just pick a day in the hospital and schedule their whole everything else around that. So to some extent, I think you could even look at the ARRIVE trial the opposite way and say that inducing low-risk patients, at least the nulliparous patients, at 39 weeks doesn't seem to increase harm. So it seems like an acceptable thing to offer if you have the capacity to. There has been some published population level data that also seems to support the claim that the ARRIVE trial lowers the C-section rate. And we can put a link to an analysis of 2.8 million births, concluding essentially that the ARRIVE trial did lower the C-section rate. But maybe, as you were saying, it only lowers the rate if it's already inappropriately high to begin with. And I can only speculate as to why. In their supplemental materials, they said there were more C-sections done in the expectant management group for fetal distress, labor arrest, and for just, quote, other reasons.
Yeah, that study is problematic, I think, though, for the exact same reasons that I just cited with the data from Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin data is far better controlled. When you're publishing analysis of 2.8 million births from registry and CPT codes, you're going to be plagued with inconsistencies. But in the same way, though, across the country, maybe people implemented the ARRIVE trial data in their implementation. Maybe they didn't. They don't know that. But during the pandemic, everything changed. We were diagnosing less hypertension and inducing less women because they had fewer in-person visits. We know that's true. We were doing less and less STs and BPPs and things like that because people didn't come for visits or those sorts of things, and then inducing women for fewer reasons related to those abnormal NSTs or biophysical profiles. So the whole game was different during the pandemic. And to act like that one paper published somehow led to a significant decrease in the rate of C-section during a global pandemic when virtually every metric of prenatal care changed, I think is a little hubristic. So I don't think that data really applies at all. And that's why I like the University of Wisconsin data. I will say I agree with you about 39-week inductions. Plenty of women do want them, and I have no problem inducing women who electively want it, but we do have to be careful that we're giving them the right data. And so if they have a closed, thick, and high cervix and it's their first baby at 39 weeks and they want to be induced, I will induce them. But I'm counseling them that that's likely to increase their C-section rate, particularly since I have an NTSV rate that's significantly south of 10%. That's the appropriate counseling for my patients. So my emphasis is just, let's not make them think that it's going to lead to less fetal demises or morbidity when the publication didn't say that. And you may need to individualize your counseling in respect to your institution and your personal C-section rate.
There is still a desire to do something to lower the risk of fetal demise or other adverse outcomes in women past 39 weeks, especially if we're not going to universally induce them all at 39 weeks. So for this, there was a paper in the Gray Journal in March 2023 that looked at antenatal surveillance after 39 weeks for women of South Asian ancestry in Australia, because those women are apparently known to have higher rates of fetal demises. And it's 5 times the risk compared to the general Australian population. So for these South Asian patients, they did biweekly monitoring with a non-stress test on one of those days and then a measurement of amniotic fluid on the other day of the week, starting at 39 weeks. This practice actually lowered the neonatal death rate from 3.1 to 1.3 per thousand, and it also decreased the risk of admission to the special care nursery for those babies. It did result in an increased rate of labor induction from 35.4% up to 43.2%. But with that increase, the C-section rate only increased by 0.33%. And the C-section rate was already a bit high. So it went from 32% up to 32.3%. The neonatal death rate in all of the other Australian women that were not of South Asian ancestry was baseline 1.3%. So essentially, this extra testing decreased the excess risk of neonatal death for women of South Asian ancestry down to the baseline of the general population. And note that even that is still much higher than the rates of death in the low-risk ARRIVE trial population.
Yeah, I do think this is a valuable article, not because we're in Australia, but the ideas behind it. What we need to find is which women really benefit from earlier induction of labor and or from extra antenatal testing, and which women do not. This article adds to our knowledge about that. It would be a mistake, of course, to assume that implementing this in a low-risk Caucasian population or African-American population or some other population would have the exact same benefit. But those populations need to be studied. We need to study other populations and drill down on obesity or other factors where the testing is beneficial or induction may be beneficial. But I do think it's interesting also to note, as you said, that despite increasing the number of inductions that they needed to do because of the antenatal testing, they did not decrease the cesarean delivery rate, which is what we would be led to believe the ARRIVE trial would predict. If anything, it went up by 0.33%, but it wasn't statistically significantly different. So I think the takeaway from a lot of this is that we should offer women induction of labor who are good candidates at 39 weeks, meaning who have a favorable cervix or who have any medical risk factors that might be associated with an increased risk of perinatal death. But there just isn't convincing evidence that super healthy, low-risk women with unfavorable cervixes in particular will have any benefit, and nor any evidence that their babies will have any benefit from earlier induction. It would also be a mistake to say that induction will lower their risk of cesarean when every other study says the opposite, particularly if your baseline NTSV cesarean rate is below 18% or so already.
All right. Well, let's move on to some of the articles from a recent AJOG edition. So in our recent episode about breech delivery, you criticized a 2005 article that had claimed that home birth was as safe or safer than hospital birth. And the authors of that paper were also the same authors that were pushing studies claiming shorter labors with upright birthing position. So we were talking about that whole upright or hands and knees thing for breech delivery. Well, there is a new report in the May 2023 Gray Journal special edition on labor and delivery at term. And this article is called The Impact of Birth Settings on Pregnancy Outcomes in the United States. And here they do a good job of talking about how these vital statistics are collected, and in particular, the limitations of home birth registries, which are voluntary, where much of the data about the safety of home birth is derived. It's really a quite good article in discussing the methodology needed to dissect this issue. And it also talks about the sorts of patients who should opt out of home birth based on the data that they have. And it provides a nice checklist for discussion with patients who are interested in home birth that you might be counseling them about.
Yeah, it is a great article. And it also gets into the ethics, of course, of respecting a patient's decisions and autonomy who might be interested in home birth, but it promotes the tools and information you need to help patients make a truly informed decision. Our job is to help patients understand what they need to know to make an informed decision. And I think that this does not always happen because many patients who seek out home births, well, they're not being counseled maybe at all by physicians. And in many cases, they're not being counseled appropriately, particularly in light of that study we talked about in the last episode, which is handed out to patients as a selling point by a lot of home birth midwives. But the bottom line of this study was that neonatal mortality rates for planned home births were 13.6 per 10,000 live births, compared to 3.27 for 10,000 live births in the hospital setting. So more than a fourfold difference. These were among deliveries attended in both cases by nurse midwives, so that the attendant's level of training or skill level was not a confounding factor, just the setting itself, hospital or home. And of course, we know that for every newborn who dies, there are many more near misses who may have permanent disability or neurologic injury, even though they didn't die, and other significant morbidities or complications. So death is often the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. The checklist they suggest, I think, is nice and really helpful. Obviously, home births are associated with fewer interventions. And of course, that's almost presented oftentimes as something that is just universally a good thing. But the wording of the first item on this checklist, it doesn't necessarily put it that way. It says there are less interventions available outside of the hospital so that they can't be given even when they're indicated. So, for example, obviously you cannot give a blood transfusion at a home birth to a mom or a baby that's hemorrhaging. So less interventions, but that's not always a good thing. And this checklist goes on to emphasize that interventions can be kept to a bare minimum in the hospital as well, because I think some people assume that walking into a hospital means that every possible intervention that they have is just forced on patients for impersonal reasons, like this is our policy, or we're preventing liability for ourselves, or we're profiting from pushing all these interventions on you. I've definitely seen patients bring in birth plans where they're like cautiously asking, can I please not have an episiotomy, or please not have an enema? And almost as if they're expecting me to be like, no, you must have those things.
It's not 1955.
Yeah. So a lot of interventions that patients are hoping to avoid and maybe considering a home birth to avoid are actually already against good hospital practice. And even the good interventions that people sometimes also want to avoid, like I would say Pitocin after delivery for prevention of hemorrhage, I think that's a good intervention, but some people want to avoid that. Even some of those requests can often be accommodated, at least to an extent, in the hospital, as long as there's no signs that now that mom's life is threatened and she's hemorrhaging, but we won't give the Pitocin because she didn't want it.
And we can at least have informed conversations with the patient, and she has autonomy. We don't do things against her will. And actually, since it's a global fee, we make less money when we do interventions. So we're not doing this for money or anything like that. We're trying to give her and her baby the safest possible entrance into the world, I suppose. Also, in that article is a list of conditions that are appropriate for the hospital. And I thought it was very good, too. One of those is nulliparous patients. It's on the list. So I don't think many folks realize that a lot of the research on intentional home birth in Europe excludes women with even minimal risk factors. They're very well-selected home birth candidates. But when that literature is translated to counseling in the United States, and we try to say that home birth is as safe as home birth in Europe, a lot gets lost in translation. Many of the women delivering at home in the United States do have significant risk factors, even including things like previous cesarean deliveries. And most of them don't have the very tight integrated transfer and transport of options available. They live further from hospitals than they do, say, in Denmark, things like that. So the data is not comparable.
There are a lot of other great articles in that same AJOG edition. It's definitely worth browsing through. So let's just try to highlight a few more. There's an article called A Wider Agreement is Needed on Basic Intrapartum Concepts that I thought was good as well. It discusses variation in definitions on things like who should be admitted for labor, or what's the definition of labor arrest? How long can a woman push before she should be offered or recommended an assisted delivery?
Yeah, I think people are surprised to hear that we don't really have universal agreement on some of these definitions or terms. When I was at the ACOG meeting in Baltimore, there was a person who asked a question after a talk about the length of time for maternal pushing and was frustrated with the 3-hour, 4-hour kind of rule. I think people are confused sometimes between arrest of descent, which is an hour, and a failed second stage. She seemed very frustrated because she was talking about a patient who had made no progress at all with pushing for an hour, but she felt like she was required to give 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever the criteria was for the length of the second stage. But those are totally different concepts. They're different criteria.
Yeah, and they point out the difference between the ACOG definition of how long a woman should push compared to the World Health Organization criteria and the National Institute for Healthcare and Excellence guidelines. So what they use in the UK.
Nice. Yeah.
They are essentially the same, but the wording can leave some room for various interpretations. They say that multiparous patients should expect to deliver within 2 hours of starting to push and nullips within 3 hours. But yes, if you push for 1 hour and there's no progress at all, then that is still technically arrest of descent.
Yeah, and an indication for a cesarean. Yeah. Well, the definition of arrested labor is also different between those three organizations. So the WHO and the NICE focus on the rates of labor progression rather than absolute definitions like ACOG offers. And of course, there's really no definition about who should be admitted in labor in the United States. Like how dilated should you be? How often should you be contracting? Things like that. So you see quite a bit of clinical variation when you look at different hospitals and practices. And some of that may lead to different rates of cesareans. If women, for example, are admitted too early in labor. So, for example, if a woman comes in and she's contracting some and she's 1 centimeter, and then a couple hours later she changes to 2 centimeters, well, many physicians might admit her for labor because she's contracting and made cervical change. But she may not actually be in labor. And think about all the women you induce at 39 or 40 weeks who are already 3 or 4 centimeters. They got there at some point. But now you've admitted her for labor, and then she's slow, she's protracted, so now you're giving her pit, you're breaking her water at 2 centimeters, and what you're really doing is an induction, but you're holding her to the criteria of somebody in active labor. But many of our European colleagues, they would have just sent her home at the first initial exam when she was 1 centimeter and told her to come back later. So we vary widely in how we handle that.
And not just European, but U.S. military colleagues.
Well, there you go. Another pro for the military.
I mean, if someone's changing from 1 to 2 centimeters, I think we would say, like, do you want to be induced?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Or go home.
But you're going to hold her to different labor expectations if it's an induction rather than a spontaneous labor.
Yeah. So another unclarified concept here that I think you talk about a lot is whether or not these parameters are a floor or a ceiling. So in other words, what do you do if someone has no cervical change after 4 hours with adequate uterine contractions and is in active labor? Or what do you do with someone who's a nullip who has been pushing for 3 hours? Have they now hit their max time that they had and now they have to get a C-section? Or have they hit the minimum time for which now they can keep going, but now you can also consider a C-section at some point?
Yeah, the floor or the ceiling. I think this is a really critical concept. So if you view those parameters as the ceiling, then you may believe that once you've met those thresholds, you should proceed immediately with cesarean delivery or perhaps an operative delivery if they're a candidate after pushing and they've had adequate fetal descent. But I think that the science about these parameters should be understood that these are a floor, not a ceiling. So once you've gotten to a point where you've seen an abnormal labor pattern or a partogram, this protracted abnormal type labor, then you should think of it as we're now entering into the room, we're entering into an area, a phase where we should be asking some questions and assessing a situation and then determining in some cases that cesarean is appropriate and is a safer option, or in many cases, more time is appropriate. So one option is proceeding with an operative delivery right away because you finally met the criteria checkbox. You've been sitting, sharpening your scalpel, waiting on the clock to tick down 3 more minutes and run in and check her and she's not changed. But another option is to give her more time and be patient, especially if the mom and baby are doing fine, there's no other concerns, and if it's her preference to continue on and you have no reason to believe that the prognosis for a vaginal delivery is anything but good if she had enough time. So you have to consider all these things in order to know what's best for the patient. How big is the fetus? Is there a correctable malpresentation of the head? Does she have adequate oxytocin or adequate contractions? And that's where I think the floor and ceiling concept comes in again. We've talked about this before, because while, yes, it's true that 200 Montevideo units are adequate for about 90% of women to progress in their labor, it's not adequate for the next 10%. And so perhaps she just needs more oxytocin, despite the fact she's been at 200 Montevideo units for 4 hours. How's the baby doing? How's the fetal tracing? How, if she's pushing, how adequately has she been pushing? Does she have a really dense epidural and it took her 1.5 hours to even learn how to push? And once you get past those thresholds, operative deliveries are now part of the conversation. They're now an available tool in the armamentarium, but they're not automatically indicated by any means. So this is one of the biggest things I can encourage people is to think of these as a floor, not a ceiling.
I think the difference in terminology that's addressed in this article does reflect that view. This is an attitude issue, but more clear guidelines about what should happen once you meet those thresholds, especially from ACOG, would go a long way for sure. When you admit a person in labor and put them on a clock and you're looking for these time thresholds and you're just sharpening your scalpel and waiting for them to fail by this metric, then it definitely will impact how many cesareans you do.
There's also several articles, speaking of labor curves, there are several articles in this issue which talk about the partogram and labor curves and the evidence around those, particularly the history of them and how they were established and the debates around them. And there are a few articles in this that have been co-authored by Dr. Emmanuel Friedman, who is still alive. I don't know his exact age, but I believe he's in his mid-90s. But this is the physician who in the 1950s gave us the Friedman curve that we all learned as medical students. And recall, this defines active labor starting at a smaller dilation than we currently use, usually 4 centimeters, maybe even 3, and progressing much faster than what our current day understanding is from the Zhang curve and things like that. Now, I do feel like these articles were included to give Dr. Friedman an opportunity to maybe rehabilitate and defend his labor curve somewhat that we've now essentially abandoned with the work of Zhang and colleagues. So they're opinion pieces, and he has a right to write about his career and his work and his thoughts. But it is interesting to me that so many of them were published and they don't present new data. They're just opinion pieces. So keep that in mind when you read them. I do think you should read them, but keep that in mind when you read them. They don't reveal new evidence or new clinical trials or things like that, but they give Dr. Friedman an opportunity to defend his nearly 70-year-old labor curve. But I would say that that labor curve has only led to an increase in the cesarean rate of delivery. And for me, we've moved well beyond it at this point. So they're interesting articles, but don't look at them as some sort of scientific consensus.
Well, the good news is there are also counterpoints to these articles. And so one of them is an article that's a systematic review on the topic of labor curves authored by Zhang. So make sure you read all of them to get the full picture. The systematic review has a great rundown of all the studies that have been done about the timing and duration of the active phase of labor, starting with Friedman all the way to the most recent studies. And it's a pretty good resource, just like a lot of the other articles are too in this edition. And they also include a similar review for the duration of the second stage. And to answer Friedman's concerns about giving women longer than we historically did for labor, there's also a review of outcomes correlated with the duration of labor. Overall, I think it supports where we're at right now, but also demonstrates how uncertain some of these problems still are.
Yeah, and that uncertainty, I think, comes really from having a hard time knowing prospectively or concurrently during the labor when active labor has started. So this is a retrospective observation. You can chart the labor course over time and you can then see where active labor started, but it's different for different women. So everyone's trying to delineate when active labor started and then what the expectations should be for her labor based upon that time point. But as it's something that we can see looking back, not in the moment. And that's the main problem. So if you say active labor starts at 4 centimeters, then you'll overdiagnose active labor and you'll do perhaps too many cesareans for arrest disorders based upon the expectation that those patients are in active labor. So the real question is, what's the negative of saying that it starts at 6 centimeters, which is what we're doing now, and have some patience? And so far, we haven't seen any negatives, and that's what we're doing right now.
Okay, I thought another good article was an opinion piece about the 30-minute rule from decision to incision when talking about C-sections. Obviously, there's no great evidence basis for this 30-minute rule, and some cesareans that are declared after labor has started for reasons like labor arrest or that the patient was planning a cesarean but now they showed up earlier in labor really allow for much more time than 30 minutes from decision to incision. But on the other hand, there's scenarios like uterine rupture or cord prolapse that have to be much quicker than 30 minutes or else you're too late. The authors suggested a 4-tier classification, which I think a lot of places have already adopted. I've seen it in multiple places that I've worked at.
Yeah, and this would go a long way to clearing up confusion with OR staff and anesthesia and others if we could just communicate this way rather than treating every cesarean the same way. So the class 1 cesareans would be things like you mentioned, true emergencies, umbilical cord prolapse, sustained fetal bradycardia, complete abruption, or a cesarean done at the time needed for maternal resuscitation, for example, something like that. It's where seconds count. Everyone needs to be focused, moving swiftly. You really just have a few minutes if you're going to make a measurable impact on saving the life of the baby or in some cases the mother. Then the class 2 would be for cesareans that were done for worsening maternal or fetal status, but not in a situation of immediate life-threatening circumstances. So think things like worsening HELLP syndrome or maybe a category 2 fetal heart rate tracing that's been persistent, things like that. It's still a situation where you're not going to wait 8 hours until she's in PO or something like that, and you need to leave clinic and come do it and get it done, but you've still got the 30 minutes at least to get transitioned to the OR and do so in a safe manner. And if it's not exactly 30 minutes, it's okay in most circumstances. And then a class 3 cesarean would be for things like labor arrest, where there's otherwise reassuring maternal and fetal status. You can probably wait until the whole team is there and maybe they can finish that appendectomy they're doing before you go back for the cesarean. It doesn't have to be done in 30 minutes and plenty of time to let her last meal clear, perhaps, if necessary. You could handle any other urgent patient issues in the interim without having to call in backup. You don't need to call another team or second team or doctor in, things like that. So this could be hours in some cases. Do it as soon as you can, but it's not an emergency. And then the class 4 are all those scheduled elective cesareans done for things like breech presentation or a known placenta previa or maybe a previous cesarean who wants a repeat, but she's not in labor, things like that. That could even be deferred to the next day if needed to be.
Yeah. So instead of class 1, 2, 3, 4, I've seen it broken down similarly as descriptions, emergent, urgent, unscheduled, and scheduled. But either way, it allows for a logical and standardized way to communicate the urgency of cesarean, both to the rest of the care team in the moment and also in your documentation.
Well, and there's also potentially a significant legal risk to having this arbitrary, non-evidence-based, non-scientific 30-minute rule. So unfortunately, there's been lawsuits lost due to the claim of the breach of standard of care was that the C-section was at 32 minutes instead of 30, when that might not have even made a difference in her care. Okay, well, there were also several other interesting articles, including some basic science expert opinion articles about the methods of contractility of the uterus. It's actually one of my favorite topics, so that was very fascinating to me. We can talk about it sometime. The causes of decelerations that are not associated with hypoxia, evidence about how much head compression contributes to decelerations, thoughts about objective measurements of labor, of contractions, and of cervical progression during labor, things like that. Some really good stuff about interpretation of blood gases and lactate levels at birth, and some basic science reviews that are really quite good regarding the pain and the pain pathways during labor, mechanisms of action of different pain medications we use, things like that. So all worth reading. We'll probably come back in future episodes and use some of these and talk about them because there's a lot of good stuff in there. And this is part one. There's a part two coming.
Are we going to talk about the peanut ball article?
I knew you would do that. There's also an article about the peanut ball. I think I'll save that one for later. But if you're curious, they presented some rather low quality data that says that use of the peanut ball may shorten the first stage of labor. And though the data is very weak and low quality, they concluded that since there's no obvious harms associated with peanut ball use, then we should support using it.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to out you as a peanut ball hater.
Yeah.
I always just thought that it was just a comfort measure, that it makes labor more comfortable if someone's laying on their side, because I basically need a peanut ball just to go to sleep every night.
You have one your house. I got it for a birthday. It has a little monocle and a hat and a cane. No, I don't mind peanut balls at all, and we certainly use them and bouncy balls and things like that. What I do mind is people making outlandish claims. The companies that sell them make outlandish claims about how they affect labor course and progress and things like that, that just are simply not true. It's like our conversation about pelvic size and things like that and birthing position. These are not always innocuous claims. So I want to be clear about the science of what they do. That being said, you can do whatever you want to when you're in labor as long as it doesn't cause any harm. And if you want to push the baby while doing a handstand and you're capable of doing it, I'll support you. I'll write a case report about it, but I'll support you. So I certainly agree that we don't know of any harms that they cause, but we should be cautious about making them a standard of care and claiming that they do something they don't.
All right. Well, to be continued. So the Thinking About OBGYN website will have links to a lot of the stuff we discussed, and we'll be back again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thinkingaboutobgyn.com. Be sure to subscribe. Look for new episodes every 2 weeks.